In Buddhism, we speak a lot about purity. We uphold this ideal of purifying our minds through the practice of Dhamma. In Theravada Buddhism, the great treatise, the only great treatise which has been produced by the Theravadan school, is called the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. And when the Buddha talked about this, he used the simile of purifying gold, taking the rough gold and melting it down, skimming off all the impurities, and continually working with it. When the fire needed, when it needed more fire, then increasing the fire. When it needed less fire, then letting it cool down. Constantly skimming off the impurities that come to the top, and moving towards a place where that gold that's left behind is pure, is unadulterated. So this is one of the most difficult things in Buddhist practice, is that we want to be pure, but we live in a world that's so very impure. We have this idea in our minds of some kind of purity, of some kind of perfection. But actually that's all it is. There's just an idea in our minds. The reality that we experience is much more messy than that. Very often we come to Dhamma practice and we expect things to be very peaceful, very happy, very joyous. We expect lightness and reason and all of those things. And a lot of the time it's not like that. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And I, for myself, since I've been a monk, I've had my greatest periods of bliss and happiness have been since I've been a monk. Also some of my most depressed and tormented periods have also been while I've been a monk. And sometimes it seems that the very height of our aspiration shows everything in very sharp relief. If our aspirations are not so pure, they're not so high, and if we fail to reach them, it doesn't matter so much. But with the Dhamma, it really hurts. It really hurts when we try our best. We really try, we want to do the right thing, and yet somehow it's not good enough, or at least we see that it's not good enough. And so there's this constant struggle to purify oneself and to improve oneself. I was just reading a book by Karen Armstrong about Genesis, and it starts off with this very haunting image from the first book of the Bible, which I haven't been able to get out of my mind since then, but the image is of Jacob, one of the great Hebrew patriarchs, who at night time, the dusk was falling, a stranger came, and they fought, and all through the night here they were wrestling. Jacob was wrestling with this stranger, and they couldn't beat each other. No, neither of them could beat the other. They just wrestled and fought the whole night through, and then in the morning when the dawn came, the light shone, and he looked into the face of the stranger, and he recognized that the stranger was God. And so for the book of Genesis, this is a very beautiful metaphor of humanity and its relationship with what is pure, what is holy, what is divine. And so sometimes, you know, if we think in a theological context, we maybe think that, you know, our encounter with God will be like the clouds will part and the light will shine through and this voice will resound. And but when you look at how people have experienced it, what they believe to be what is holy, then their actual experiences are very different from that. They're very troubling and disturbing. So the same thing applies in the context of Dhamma, that we somehow we think that when we read the books and it all makes so much sense, it's all so beautiful. First you do this and then this happens and then that happens. And like it says in the gradual training, you walk for alms, come back from alms, go to the forest, sit down cross-legged and abandon the five hindrances, develop the four jhanas, get the various psychic powers and get rid of all your defilements. There it is. This is a very kind of beautiful model of the holy life. And then we always have to ask ourselves, actually, how does that relate to what we're doing, to how we're actually living? And then we think about this path of purity. Very often this is described as being purity of conduct through body, speech and mind. These are like the three doorways of action, the three ways in which we can express ourselves through karma. And as so much in Buddhism, they are a progressive series, starting with something that's relatively gross, our acts of body, and moving to our acts of speech, it's more subtle, and then our acts of the mind, which are extremely subtle. And when we're considering these acts, of course, the mind is always involved. Buddhism doesn't believe that the mind and body are separated, but that they're constantly interdependent. So that even though we speak of acts of the body, then it has to be understood that these are acts which are conditioned and ultimately caused by the mind. So ultimately the causal force has to reside in the mind, and the what we call acts of body and speech are expressions of this. The Pali word for expression is vinyakti, which is quite an interesting word. It's a causative form from consciousness. It like means making known, making the mind known. So what we do with our body and speech, our vinyatis, expressions. They're like external representations of what's going on inside our mind. And these days we're quite familiar with the idea that you can betray your mental states through this vinyati, through the appearances of your body. For example, by doing lie detection tests, and they've apparently become much more accurate and subtle. And so the psychologists with the right kind of training and equipment are able to tell with a fair degree of accuracy from a person's bodily movement or physiological reactions whether something they're saying is a lie or not. So this is all part of that kaya vinyati. It's like our body is mirroring and expressing where our mind is at. So when we think of purification of the body, then we initially think of keeping the precepts, especially the first three precepts: to not kill, not steal, and be sexually restrained. So I don't think that these precepts are too much of a problem for the community of people here in this monastery. We don't go around habitually killing animals. Even insects, we avoid killing them very scrupulously. Stealing, not something that people here do. We're very trustworthy. We look after each other's possessions. And, you know, people are very conscientious about using things in the monastery. And as far as sexual restraint goes, and as monastics and anagarikas, then we have the precept of practicing celibacy. And so this means we refrain from sexual intercourse, refrain from any other kind of overt sexual acts using our body. And again, I don't think this has been a problem. I haven't seen that be a problem in this monastery since I've been here. As far as I can see, people here are very sincere and are committed to their holy life and committed to their precepts. So we haven't really had too much problems in that regard. So this is already a very substantial establishment of our bodily purity, purity of our physical acts. And we should all congratulate ourselves for that. We should all appreciate what we've been doing and appreciate the fact that we have been able to create and sustain a community on these on this basis. Of course, there's a lot more to bodily purity than just keeping these three precepts. As samanas, as those who have gone forth or are intent upon going forth, then we also have the practice of being very restrained with our requisites. We should be people who want little. We should be people who are content with any old robe at all, as long as we're warm enough, then it's okay. We shouldn't need to find the most soft or refined or beautiful cloth. We don't need those things. What do we need? We need just enough to get by. We should be ones who are satisfied with any old alms food at all. So we remember that the duty or the heritage of the samana is just whatever one collects on alms round. Everything else is atireka labho. It's extra gains, luxury. So the problem, of course, is that we start out with very good intentions, but we get used to luxuries very, very easily. We come to think that it's normal. Then we should have, you know, fresh food cooked in the kitchen for us every day. It's not normal. This is a something which is very unusual. In most monasteries, most of the time, then you just go out and get what you can for alms. And so from the time next week when anagarikas will be ordaining, then if we don't have enough food, if people aren't bringing the food to support the monastery, then That's what we'll do. We just get our bowls and we walk into the town. And we wander around the streets until we get enough to eat. Sometimes if we don't get anything, then we just don't get anything. So you have to learn how to fast. So this is your training. That's what you should understand, those who wish to ordain here, that we're quite serious about this, about keeping these heritages of the Sangha. And I don't ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do myself, and I don't ask you to do anything which I haven't in fact done myself for long periods of time. And I've spent many, many months, more than a year or 2 years, probably even more than that, living just on the alms food which I've got in the village. Sometimes that's in places where you get a lot of alms food, but most of the time it's in places where you don't get very much alms food. So this is our heritage, it's a very glorious heritage. Because when you can train yourself in this way, when you can train yourself to just be content, it doesn't even cross your mind to start hinting and suggesting that we need this kind of food or we need that kind of food or that such and such is going to be appropriate to offer. It doesn't even cross your mind to think in that way. And then you have this freedom and this purity. You know that if there isn't any food, if no one comes to the monastery to bring food, then you've always got your insurance policy as your bowl. Many years ago, when Ajahn Pasano was the abbot of Wat Nanachat, and he was in Bangkok, and one of the wealthy supporters in Bangkok wanted to establish a fund to buy food for the monks at the monastery of Wat Nanachat, and to make sure they had enough to eat every day. And Ajahn Pasano refused. And she said, she wants it to be an insurance policy. And Ajahn Pasano just pointed to his bowl and said, this is our insurance policy. And the woman burst into tears. So this is the policy this is the ancient heritage of the Sangha, and this is the policy we have in this monastery. So you should consider that carefully. Anyone who wants to stay here, then that's how it is. I've always been prepared to stay here under those circumstances. And when I first came to the monastery, we didn't have people here, and it was going to be quite possible that there wasn't going to be any Anagarika here for the rains. And meanwhile, Ajahn Khema arranged to go to Melbourne for the rains, and he was quite happy to simply shut down the monastery and not have anybody staying here. But I said, look, I just don't mind. I'll stay here and I'll have faith that I'll have enough to eat. Whatever happens. So this is all part of the practice of purity of conduct and purity of livelihood. So this is something we need to keep on trying to embody these things constantly, all the time. All through the day we should be trying to embody the Dhamma in our movements. We should be bringing a sense of care, grace, balance, peacefulness to our physical activities. When we need to, when we find ourselves rushing around trying to do too many things, then we need to stop, slow down. Our Dhamma practice is not about how many things we can do, it's about how beautifully and how perfectly we can embody the Dhamma with every movement. So let's see how much we can do that working together. We can all help each other with this. When we're doing work, then let's just concentrate on that work. Let's just get done what needs to be done without making a fuss about it. And this is a context where the purity of speech also becomes very important. And here too, in the context of speech, I don't think that lying is a very big problem here. I've never heard or felt that people were lying or being dishonest or untrue. So these very kind of gross defilements, I think we're doing pretty well with those. So we have to look more carefully at those more subtle defilements. Speech that is hurtful, or speech that's inappropriate, speech that's too loud or too much, speech that is distracting others and tending to make it harder for them to focus on their own mindfulness and their own practice. So we can ask ourselves that, not merely am I not lying, am I not being kind of nasty and cruel and yelling and abusing people and so on, but am I actually using my speech constructively? Am I actually using my speech to create an appropriate environment for Dhamma practice? Am I using my speech in a way that's gentle? In a way that's uplifting? When we have some experience in meditation, when we see how soft and peaceful the mind can be, how very gentle, delicate the mind is, it's when we start to realize how badly we can mess it up by using wrong speech. Because this speech is getting very close to the mind. It's like a fairly direct movement, a very quick movement between a thought and speech, so quick that actually most of the time we don't even notice it. As I'm sitting here talking to you, most of the time I don't really consciously know the exact words that I'm going to speak. I have a vague idea, but the words that come out do so very with their own kind of spontaneity. So this is one of the things that we should train ourselves to improve our speech. We should know how to speak correctly. We should know how to speak grammatically. We should know how to pronounce words well in a way that's easy for people to understand. We should know how to express ourselves with ideas. We should know when is the time for strong and forthright speech, and when is the time for forgiving and conciliatory speech. And so when we listen to people's speech, we have a reasonable idea. We can make a reasonable guess at what's going on in their mind. Why it's so hard for to be a good actor. We know that we've all seen so many movies and programs and so on where there's bad actors, and you know, the way that they talk, we can hear that there's no sincerity to that. What they're saying is not what they're feeling, it's not what's going on in their mind. And because of that, then the words don't have any meaning. They become empty. So this is something we need to be very careful of. If we know that our minds are impure, if we know that we have anger in our hearts, then we need to really guard our speech very carefully, very strongly. You need to wrestle with it, wrestle with those defilements. Stop yourself from saying those words out of anger that are going to hurt somebody. Make yourself say those words of forgiveness. Make yourself say those words of kindness, even though it's hard to do. So as I said earlier on in this talk, that all of these actions of body and speech, they're described as being vinyati, expressions of the mind, makings of consciousness. When we start to look at the mind, it's more so very subtle. We hear these things, we hear these teachings of the five khandhas and psychological teachings like the Alita Pariyaya Sutta that we just recited. And this is very beautiful analysis of the mind and how it works. And this is why, one of the reasons why what the Buddha did was so remarkable, because when we actually look into the mind, it's so confused, isn't it? It's so vague, it's like misty and like these clouds that are always billowing and changing. How do we find some form in there? How do we find some regularity, something we can get hold of, some way we can use to understand that? And typically in ancient India, they tended to think about this thing in terms of entities, some kind of subtle things that we could identify as being the mind or mental objects and so on. In Western psychology, the mind, the way the mind's been talked about in classical psychology from Freud on, has been more these abstractions. So the way the mind is like, it's described in terms of these inferences or generalizations, which are abstracted from experience. So even though there are some parallels with the way that the Buddha taught, that they're still quite different in many ways. And what the Buddha pointed to was the function, like what is it actually doing? These different aspects of the mind, feeling and perceptions and intention and consciousness, all just different aspects of this experience that we're having here. In particular, the kinds of things we get attached to. There's not much point in talking about stuff if it's not the kind of thing we're actually going to want more of. So this is what the Buddha was pointing to in teachings like the five khandhas. And we can also feel or know these impurities of the mind. Gross impurities we can know fairly easily. Like when we get very angry with somebody, or are we wanting to harm somebody or something? Or we're wanting to try to get something in a way that's inappropriate. And kind of inappropriate desires. For example, if we're as samanas and those gone forth, if we're nursing sexual desires and fantasies, then we can see these things are very inappropriate, very obvious. And so even though these things can be very dangerous, but usually they're not actually such a problem, because they're readily recognized as a problem. So as long as we can recognize that that's there and that it is a problem, then we can get over it, we can deal with it. In fact, we've already gone halfway towards dealing with it. That's the first part, is just to diagnose it. And so when these things, we have diagnosed them, we do realize these are a problem, we accept that, and we can see them fairly easily in our mind. So actually it's not such a big problem, even though it might feel like one. It might be something that's burning up your mind for a period of time, maybe for many years it might be burning up your mind. But as long as you can recognize that it's a problem, as long as you can stick with it, then eventually that will die down, that fire will die down, and your mind will be cool and more peaceful. But what tends to be more of a problem are these kinds of subtle defilements, for example, like looking for distractions, not being peaceful with what one has, always being like delighting in one's thinking, being able to think about this and that, getting stirred up by ideas, even Dhamma ideas and Vinaya ideas. We shouldn't allow ourselves to get too stirred up and caught up with these things. There's no kind of perfect understanding of Dhamma and Vinaya, certainly in terms of the text. And there are all these grey areas and ambiguities, as we've seen this week, doing just a little bit of research in some fairly simple problems. And we see, yeah, well, there are actually all these grey areas when you start to look at it. And so while it's important to be able to investigate, inquire in these things, it's also important to realize that in the end that's just how it is, and to be able to put it down and go away and meditate. Part of the skill in being able to do that is to be able to delight in the process, or take joy in the fact that we are inquiring into Dhamma and Vinaya, and that we are in the process of moving towards or improving our understanding and practice of these things. And so we need to recognize what's kusala, what's akusala, what's good and what's bad, what leads to happiness and what leads to unhappiness. And the Buddha said that when we're living in a monastery, that we should investigate our wholesome dhammas increasing and unwholesome dhammas decreasing. And if that's not the case, if actually we can see that wholesome dhammas are decreasing and unwholesome dhammas are increasing, then we shouldn't stay there, we should leave that very day. So it's like so many things the Buddha said, it's a very challenging teaching. But it's something that's well worth investigating. If we really find that unwholesome dhammas are increasing, our minds are becoming less wholesome, less inspired, less enthused about Dhamma, then what's the reason for that? What's the causes and conditions? Perhaps sometimes it might be because the external circumstances are not conducive enough, other people are too distracting, or there's too much business or work. But usually we find that it's because our own, the way we're using our mind is not skillful. We're attending to things we shouldn't attend to, thinking about things in ways that are not skillful or useful. If we can identify these, change the way we're using with our mind, then usually we'll find that we'll be able to solve these problems. Usually. I know of one monk I met in south of Thailand, a monk from Ajahn Chah tradition, and he had ended up as the abbot of this monastery in Kanchanaburi. And he said it was a very bad monastery, the weather was very bad, the food was bad, the lay people were bad, and there was really nothing going for it. There was lots of malaria and all kinds of problems there. And yet he was there, and every day he was there he just wanted to leave. And so he just made this determination, I'm not going to leave until I don't want to leave. long as I want to go, then I'm going to stay here. And so when he made that determination, then because he made it very strongly in his mind, he was very firm and very clear, then that kind of desire and that restlessness, it had nothing to feed on anymore. And it wasn't feeding on all these expectations. So he just said, no, I'll just stay here. And yeah, of course I know it's bad, I know it's there's noise and stuff going on, and yeah, I know all the weather's really bad, and yeah, and lay people around here are all criminals, and the villagers will steal anything in the monastery if they can get their hands on it, and constantly causing problems. And you know, this is all going on, but I'll just stay here anyway. And so he stayed there for several years, and just gradually he learned to let go and let go. And then one day he got up and looked into his mind, and he thought, well, actually I'm quite contented to stay here now. You know, I've got used to it. It's not so bad. So then he got his bowl and robes and walked out the door. So this is how we need to practice with, to purify our minds. We need to just identify when these things are actual problems and learn how to solve them. And as you know, my own style as a teacher, leader of the community, I'm not somebody who goes around trying to dig everybody's problems up. I'm not somebody who, I don't believe that I can solve all of your problems. I don't know how to. And I don't think it's very useful even for me to try. So I'll always be available to help, to do what I can. And you know, whenever, if anybody here needs some advice, needs somebody to listen to them, or needs an answer to a question, then I'm always there. And I really, you know, even though sometimes I might seem like I'm busy or something, but if it's something that's really important, then really I don't care. You can come to my kuti or my little caravan I'm staying in now in the middle of the night, and come and see me and ask if you have a doubt about Dhamma and Vinaya or something that's important to you. And really I make that offering to all of you. That's quite unconditional. You don't have to worry about the fact that I seem maybe that I've got too busy or that I'm not interested. I am interested. But I prefer to just look at how things go. And generally I find that maybe it's slower, but it's generally better for people to work out their own problems and to do it in that kind of natural way. Anyway, this is how, and sometimes you can't escape from these things. This is how I was always brought up. My parents would never try to really control me too much. And when I would make my mistakes and do stupid things, and basically they would just, often they really wouldn't say anything. And they'd never punish me or anything like that. And so I just used to learn by experience. And they had enough faith to just leave me to make my own disasters, which I did fairly regularly. And because they had a lot of patience and a lot of love for me, even though it must have hurt them tremendously, but still they just let me go and let me find my own answers. And just, I would always know that they would be there to support them if I needed it. I remember one time when I was, this was in the period not all that long before I went to Thailand, and I was staying down in Coalcliffe, down near Wollongong, and I used to catch the train up and go busking in King's Cross. And that was a period in my life where in some ways it was very enjoyable, very delightful. But in other ways there was a kind of growing sense of meaninglessness and alienation, which ultimately led to me becoming a monk. And so I remember this, that one time going and playing music in King's Cross, and I often used to go down there at midnight and play music until 4 or 5 in the morning. And this time I had finished, and sometimes I would go and get a few hours sleep in just sleeping in one of the parks or something nearby. And this time I sort of left, and I was just kind of walking down the road, and I was thinking of walking down to Bronte. And I had friends living there, and I could always go and crash at their house. But just as I was going, I was just thinking, just feeling more and more lonely, more and more lost and alienated, and feeling that just there was just nowhere for me to go, and no one who really cared. And at that time, my father was living in Darlinghurst, and in an apartment there. And I thought, oh, maybe I should go and see my dad. And then I thought, no, I can't go and see him. I can't go and disturb him now. It's just early morning. It's just after dawn. What would he think? And then I thought, don't be stupid. Of course you can go and see your dad. So I just walked down from Paddington down to where my dad was staying in Darlinghurst, and just rang the... He was living in these kind of multi-story apartments, and just rang the bell down and said, oh, it's me. And then he just came up and got me and brought me back up to his place. And I was very sad, so I had a bit of a cry. And he never asked me any questions, never said, oh, you know, what's up, what's the problem, or anything like that, but he just was there. So for me, the important thing was just to know that there was somebody who I could trust, and somebody who really loved me unconditionally. And so just after, just looking after me and that, then my dad had to go off to work. So that's what he did. He just went off to work, and I stayed there for a while, and then I went off and did my own thing. And that was all. I don't think I've ever even spoken about that with my father since that time. But there wasn't any need to. So this is the example that I've been given of how I've been brought up, and how there's this like expression of true love. It's unconditional love. And this is the kind of love which everybody here should be developing, we all should have for each other. And whereas I know that in some families the parents would always kind of want their children to be a mirror image of them. They always want them to, you know, sometimes they want to live their life through their children. So they try to make the children either do what they did, or else do all the things that they wanted to do but never could. And my parents never did that with me, and they never tried to force me to do anything. And I always just went my own way, even though that way was often foolish. And I left school, and all my friends, my best friend did engineering, or my other friends did engineering or law or medicine or these kinds of things. And so I went to uni and did philosophy, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought, well, I better learn what I want to do. Now, of course, the career options for philosophers are not all that great. But my parents would support me in that, even though maybe they didn't quite understand why I was doing it, but they could appreciate it. And were very supportive. And then when I dropped out of uni and I went to play rock and roll, and they also would support that. Partly because they knew that there'd be no point in trying to argue with me, but more because that they really genuinely wanted to support me in what I was doing. So this again, this is how I've been conditioned, so this is the kind of attitude that I bring to everybody in this community, that I don't want to make you all into carbon copies of Sujato. I don't want you all to be, you know, doing the same things that I do, and having my values. I want you to all have different values. I want you to all have different orientations in the Dhamma, and I'm quite happy that every person will have a different take, something that they emphasize differently. Some people like to do some study, some people like to do the meditation, some people like to do service. All of these things are good, and I support all of them. But the hard part about that is that, you know, you don't have anybody necessarily that's going to be telling you what to do all the time. And as you know, that's how I am in this community. I don't go around saying you do this, you do that, and admonishing people whenever they slip up and telling them how to do things all the time. I just let them do things and just watch and just occasionally say something. And I try to lead and just make sure that everything's going in the right direction. So especially for those of you who are coming towards your ordination soon, I'd like to ask you to reflect on these things and reflect on how this practice is going for yourselves and your own motivations, your own sense of vocation, and how you can continue to purify your body, speech and mind through this practice. So this is all I had to offer for this evening.